Hi, Glenn Broggett with Pioneer 90.1 FM. I'm conducting interviews on our project about snowmobiling in the 1970s, the I-500, as well as the movie from 1972, It Ain't Easy. Well, this time around, we are going to talk about snowmobile culture in the 1970s. We're going to be talking about some of the major races, including the I-500. And who better to have on to talk about snowmobiling in the 1970s than a man who's a legend in the snowmobile racing industry. When you're talking enduro racing, you watch the old films, you remember this man. He's a Hall of Famer. He actually is renowned as the only driver to win the Winnipeg to St. Paul International 500 race on two different brands. This guy's been racing and competing since his early teens. He's definitely a legend up in these parts when we talk about snowmobiles. He's going to talk about the I-500, how he got into the snowmobile industry, and just how big of an impact snowmobiles have had on the culture in the 1970s, just how different it was back then. It is a big honor to welcome the Hall of Famer himself, Brian Nelson. Thank you so much for taking some time out to participate with me on this project.
Well, thank you, Glenn. Yeah, it's enjoyable to go back and talk about the old days and reminisce. And, like you were saying, it's a different world nowadays, but maybe in some ways better, and maybe some ways not so much better.
Mm-hmm. When I started researching for this project that we're putting together for a big final documentary about this time, it just amazed me just going through the old archives and watching some of the old movies and just to see what level of participation people had, not only with the racers themselves and their crews, but how people really just jumped in. Again, back in 1970, 1972, I mean, we didn't have a 24-hour news cycle. We didn't have places where you could go online with the computer world. It was a little bit more of a simpler time. But again, when you watch this, it just seemed like there was just so much more enthusiasm and participation when we look back to those old races.
Well, very much so. When snowmobiles came along, like in my life in the late 60s, it was a whole new opportunity to be able to do something in the wintertime. Back before we had snowmobiles, I mean, winters were long and boring, and there just wasn't much to do but go to school and go out and clean the barn at night. It was life was pretty stagnant, and along come snowmobiles, and oh man, we had a whole new world. We could get out, we could ride after school. We could ride our machines to school. It was freedom. I think it was sort of like what the computer has been to the kids nowadays. It opened up a whole world for them, and that's basically what the snowmobile did for us when we were young.
Mm-hmm. What was that first model that you were able to ride and kind of got you hooked?
Well, my dad came home with a 1964 Johnson ski horse, and all them old sleds were pretty rudimentary. They had bogey wheels and no suspension to speak of. And, I rode the thing all winter. And that summer, I was riding it around the alfalfa field at home on the farm. And it built up with alfalfa chafe down by the muffler. And I was way out in the field one night, and it caught on fire and burned to the ground. Nothing but a melted pile of aluminum. But I was able the next winter to get a new Skidoo, a little Bombardier, which was a much better sled in those days.
Mm-hmm. Learning your lesson, of course, it definitely put in your mind and instilled in you just how much maintenance and how much care goes into the sled as well. And that can be an obsession more than just even riding the sleds.
Well, there again, back then, if we went on a 30-mile ride, we worked on the sled for an hour or two. So you got to be a pretty good mechanic. If you loved to ride, you would learn to be a good snowmobile mechanic, And that was good, too, because it taught you a lot about maintenance and mechanics that, a person carries with them the rest of his life.
Mm-hmm. Now, you started in with the recreational route, of course. You got to learn and go ride around the farm, and it was a good way to break the monotony of the long winter season. When was it that you decided to start racing, and what was the draw? What led you into getting involved early on in your teens, I guess it was, according to your bio?
Well, it was just kind of happenstance. I had a neighbor kid that rode with me, and we had a lot of fun out riding every night. And one weekend, his dad came, and he said that there's a little race over in Grove City, Minnesota, a little snowcross race out in an alfalfa field. And he said, "You kids are good riders. I'm going to take you over there and see how you do." And his name was Irv Tullickson. He was a kind of a neat guy, you know, and he was into trying to help us all he could. So we went over to Grove City, and he entered his son, and he entered me, and went out there and raced and won my class. And I remember running, you know, I had this little 16-horse stock skidoo, and I remember passing these guys on these full mod sleds that had 634s and megaphones sticking out the side. You know, they were loud, and I was passing them, and I figured, man, is this is just a blast. You know, I mean, I was hooked.
Mm-hmm.
Then one thing led to another, and, you know, we started going to more and more races, and before I could drive, I would hitch a ride to a race. You know, back then there was races at all the small towns in Minnesota. They'd have a cross country on Saturday and an oval on Sunday, and I'd hitch a ride there, and somebody would always give me a sled to ride. And I rode snow jets, skidoos, I didn't care what it was. If somebody needed a driver, mm-hmm. I was there, you know. And that's kind of how I got started.
And that really did pay off for you, too, you know, learning and being so eager to ride whatever sled they gave you. And that really must have opened a lot of eyes and opened a lot of doors to you getting involved in the pro ranks. Now, talk about making that transition to the pro ranks. Who did the recruiting, and what sled did you end up with early on?
Well, kind of how that all started was in 1974. I was sponsored by a group from Wilmer, a group of area businessmen. Got together and bought me a sled and gave me some money, and that was a huge, huge help. You know, they called it the Spirit of Wilmer, and we did real well with the Spirit of Wilmer. And at the time, the sled they bought me was a John Deere. And then the next year, in the spring of 75, going into the 76 season, John Deere was putting together a team called Enduro Team Deere, and they had been watching us, and they saw how well we were doing, and they came out and offered me a job, and I said, "Well, I'll go to work for you, but you have to hire my two mechanics, Larry and Hubert." And they did, and we just took it from there. And it was an opportunity of a lifetime to have unlimited budget, coaches, the best equipment, everything we needed, you know. And I took advantage of it. You know, I mean, I worked my little tail off to do everything as good as I could, and it paid off.
And how important really was it to also have your friends, with Hubert and your other buddy on your team? Because, you know, it really helped you out and really furthered your advancement. But just how important was that to be able to have that freedom and to be able to bring those guys along in to be such integral parts of your team?
Well, it was extremely valuable. You know, like when we went to work for Deere, then they gave Hubert to Bobby Enns. And they got along great, you know, they gave Larry, to Bobby Enns, and Larry and Bobby got along terrific and blended. But Larry and Hubert both had just graduated from college with their degrees in mechanical engineering. So they were extremely talented, you know, terrific guys. And Bobby went on to win a bunch of races with Larry. And Hubert and I stayed together. But, you know, we had worked together for so many years. We knew exactly... You know, for example, I go out and ride the sled and come back in and tell Hubert what it's doing, and he knew right away what it took to make the sled change, you know, to make the sled work better for me, you know, be it clutching, jetting, or whatever. And we just had that natural connection, you know, where he knew what I wanted, and I trusted him 100% because he never made a mistake. You know, he was just extremely talented. So that was a huge advantage for us, you know, versus some of the other guys that came on the team, and they were assigned mechanics that they didn't know and had never worked with. So being able to have that bond, that partnership with somebody that you had worked with for quite a few years was extremely valuable.
Mm-hmm. And most definitely, too, when you're going into the enduro race circuit, I mean, when we talk about races like the I-500, I mean, that is the ultimate test of a person's endurance. And you got to have not only be fit mentally, physically, but your equipment has to be ready to go, or you need to have somebody there to help you, or just to have that machine that runs and makes it through. What was it like to enter into a circuit that included these long enduro races? I mean, it's a little bit more than just your basic Saturday afternoon.
Well, you know, we had been running cross-country races, you know, shorter ones, of course, for a number of years. And You know, the 500 was basically in its day, you know, it was 600 miles, but it was like four legs, you know, so you just tackled each leg no different than, you know, a team takes or tackles quarters in a football game. And so we just would set up for each day and take one day at a time and do the best we could. But, yeah, it was, you know, we kind of looked at it as we were students of the game. You know, we would look at what's it going to take to succeed? You know, what do we have to do to be the best that we can physically, mentally, sled prep? And, of course, back then, you know, machines weren't very dependable. So we had to, you know, you could easily destroy your machine. You know, you could ride it too hard and tear the skis off and break the suspension and on and on and on. But so you really had to know the machine. You had to ride it on the edge so you didn't destroy it. And you really had to have a feel for your equipment.
Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about some of these races themselves here, and most notably the one that you happen to have won a couple of times. But I want to talk about the Winnipeg to St. Paul I-500, and it was in 1976 you recorded your first Winnipeg to St. Paul I-500 win. Could you take us back to just the whole that race itself, and maybe some of the moments leading up to it, the races leading up to it, how you were going into that race, how were you feeling, what was your mind like getting yourself ready to prepare for a big race and to be able to pull it off? I mean, this is a very impressive feat.
Well, you know, we looked at each race as just another event, and we never looked past the race we were on. No different than football players at a game. You know, you've got to concentrate on the one that you have in front of you versus looking down the road. So, and every race was somewhat different. So we set up quite a bit different as far as how we put the sled together and set up our studs and our wear rods and everything from one event to another. But, you know, so I remember we built the I-500 sled in 76. You know, we would hand build our sleds back then. We would spend, you know, 200 to 300 hours building each machine, and we'd build them from the ground up. I mean, we would inspect the spindles, the chains, the skis, every part on it. We'd re-weld all the suspension components, the bulkheads. Nothing went on that sled without being inspected by Hubert and myself, and because it was just an accomplishment just to finish. You know, for example, like in 1976, I think about 400 sleds started and 70 some finished. So, you know, most people were just happy to finish, but of course we wanted to win. And, you know, so I didn't, you know, if you sit around and you dream of trophies and dollars and glory, you're never going to win a race. But if you look at what it takes, the ingredients that you got to have there to do it, just all, it's a detail thing. You got to have the right gloves, right height windshield, the right goggles. It's all detail. And if you make sure that all those details are in order, and there's hundreds of them, the winning will take care of itself.
And you actually had to overcome a bit of a deficit, too, in this race. I mean, to be able to come back and shave the time off, just to shave it enough time to get competitive, but to be able to do it and to take over and win on the final day, I mean, that had to be also a physical, that had to take some sort of a physical toll once the race was all said and done, you know, with your machine as well.
Well, yeah, it was, you know, typical back then. Not everything went according to plan, you know, and that race went north that year. And of course, we started in the Maplewood Mall parking lot in St. Paul. And the first day, there was a lot of snow. And you know, the liquidator was a pretty heavy machine. And I had three spare belts and plus the one I started with. And I blew all three of my spare belts, and I was down to the last belt. And so I had to slow down a little bit to make it into Alexandria, but I was in fourth place about 12 minutes out of first. And Polaris had first, second, and third, and they had the better sled. I mean, they had the light little TXs, and they went through that loose snow like it wasn't even there, you know, and our big liquidators kind of wallered through the bottom of it, you might say, and you know, we were over 100 pounds heavier. And we went from Alexandria to Walker that year, and they dropped the flag, and I took off, and I was going to make up my 12 minutes. I was coming down a logging road back in the woods, and the road was plowed, and all of a sudden the road wasn't plowed, and I was going to 85, 90. I hit the bank where the road stopped being plowed, and I flew out into the woods and landed in a cattail swamp. And by the time I got out of there, the lead players had caught me again, and I got together with them and started snowing real hard, and we got on Leech Lake and couldn't make any time anymore. You couldn't see anything. You know, we're lucky we found the finish line, but I was still 12 minutes out. Well, then on day three, we left Walker to go to Thief River, and it was a cold, clear morning. The snow had quit, and the front had went through, and it was, you know, 20 below, but a bright, sunny day, and they dropped the flag, and we took off across Leech Lake, and I was, you know, determined to make up my 12 minutes. But about halfway across the lake, the machine quit running on one cylinder, and I wasn't going to stop out in the middle of the lake because, you know, you'd freeze to death because we didn't wear much. And so I figured, well, I get across the lake, I'll find a vehicle, and I'll stop and try and work on the sled. If I can't get it going, at least I can get in where it's warm. But when I got across the lake, meantime, going across the lake, the first flight passed me, the second flight passed me, and, you know, 20-some sleds got ahead of me. And as soon as I got in the ditch on the other side of the lake in the woods, whatever was in the carburetor, I think it was a piece of ice, must have melted and passed, and the thing took off on two cylinders, and away I went, you know, passing sleds, making time. And when I got to Thief River, the three lead Polaris had made two more minutes up on me. So now I'm 14 minutes out with one day to go. So they, you know, they lined us up that next morning in Thief River, and there was 10 on the first flight, and there was 9 factory Polaris riders and me and my John Deere. And it was a flat light day, which was good when you had to make up a lot of time. Because, you know, on flat light, it's really hard to see the drifts. And when you go north, when there's a lot of snow up in that part of the country, as you well know, the drifts are like concrete. And the sharp edges are facing south because the predominant wind is northwest. So it was ideal conditions for a guy that had to make up 14 minutes. Because you couldn't run wide open, you know, most of them couldn't. But I was pretty, you know, I wasn't psyched out or anything. We had a Suburban right by the start-finish line there, and I actually fell asleep. I was taking a nap there, and pretty soon Hubert pokes me, and he said, "You better get out there." He said, "They're getting ready to go." So I woke up, put my helmet on, and I walked out there, pulled the rope, sat on the sled, and they dropped the flag. And in my own mind, I just figured I was, you know, I didn't say anything to anybody prior. You know, we didn't talk about it. I just figured I'm going to be the first one to Winnipeg or go for a hell of a crash, you know. And I just put that liquidator wide open, and away we went. And Donnie Omdahl from Polaris, he hung with for about 5 or 6 miles, and we were hitting them big approaches in that Highway 59 ditch, you know, flat out and getting big air, and which, you know, with no suspension, when you landed, you hit awful hard. But out of the corner of my eye, I saw Donnie, he was right alongside of me, and we hit this approach, and he was cartwheeling end for end, and he was off the sled. And of course, I didn't slow down, but when he landed, he had a compound fracture. It ended his career pretty much. But I just kept that thing, rode, you know, flat out as fast as it would go, keep looking for hard snow, keep making speed, you know, just making every ounce of speed you can, and just not slowing down. And, you know, with no suspension, you'd hit so hard you'd see stars. You'd just about black out at times. And, you know, you'd hit things and you'd feel yourself going up in the air and you'd be off the sled, but you had to get back on that sled before it hit the ground. And it was, I had a lot of, you know, 3 or 4 near misses. You know, one time I was off the sled and got back. I was about half on the sled when it hit the ground, and it about peeled my right leg off, you know. And the next day after the race, my right leg was black, you know, from my hip down to my toes. But you get in a mindset, you get in a zone, and you're just 110% concentrating on what's happening. You're not thinking about anything else, you know. And got into the fuel stop, and that was a disaster. I was the first one in there, and it took 2.5 minutes to get fuel. And the next sleds that came in, it took them like 30-some seconds. And get to the border, and there was some issues getting across the border, and got into Canada, and wide open again, you know, and you know, things, it was just the ride of a lifetime, you know. I mean, I just, luckily the sled held up, and I got into Winnipeg, and you know, won by 32 seconds.
Very impressive. And what was it like after the race itself, just, you know, unraveling after you made it through multiple days and you've made it and you stayed so focused and you avoided any sort of pitfalls? But what is it like to just finally take the helmet off and just acknowledge the victory and basically just decompress?
You know, we were, I don't think we were aware at the time of actually what we had done. You know, it was just a job that we did, and you know, it means more looking back at it today than it did then. You know, I mean, then all we could think about was going to the award ceremony and getting the sled ready for the next race. You know, it was, I mean, we tried to be as humble as we could. You know, we didn't, you know, we did the interviews and did all the media stuff, but I mean, there was another race the next weekend, so that we wanted to win, you know. And it was, you know, Hubert was, my buddy Hubert was extremely a logical person. I mean, well, he still is. But so he would always tell me, we're not going to get up over this, but we're not going to get down when we get beat either. We're just going to keep the same level of optimism and the same approach toward everything we do all winter long. You know, we're not going to get high when things are going good. You know, we're not going to get low when things aren't going good. We're just going to tackle everything with the same amount of energy and passion and see what happens. So we didn't really celebrate. You know, we went to the banquet, did the speeches. You know, Deer had a huge party at the Holiday Inn before the banquet, and there must have been 200 people in there. And the president of John Deere, Bob Carlson, he hung a big wreath over our shoulders and poured champagne over our heads. And I mean, it was really cool. I mean, it was, looking back at it now, it was really a neat experience, you know. And but we were, you know, young and somewhat naive and just, you know, didn't even really know. You know, I don't think we realized what we had achieved. And so, yeah, we went through the banquet and worked on our sled and got ready for the next race.
How long of a season do these go as far as the Enduro circuit? How many races, I mean, ballpark figure, did you race per year there when you were going pretty hot and heavy?
Well, we usually had eight, but we usually, we would go to Alaska in October and do some oval racing up there, and that would be an extra event. Then we'd usually go out to West Yellowstone and run in the fall roundup at Yellowstone, too. So we'd have about 10 events, but we rode every day. You know, we would test, we'd go out and ride 50 to 100 miles almost every day testing. And, you know, we worked out every day. We would spend 2.5-3 hours a day doing physical work. And, I mean, everything we did 7 days a week, every waking hour, was to improve what we were doing. You know, I remember at times, like when we worked for Articat, we shared an apartment, Hubert be in the other bedroom, and 2 a.m. he would holler and he said, "Are you still awake?" He'd wake me up, you know, and he had been thinking about something we could do to the sled to be better. You know, I mean, it's just, it consumed you. It was all you thought about and all you did. You know, we didn't go out drinking, we didn't go partying, we didn't let any other activity get in the way of the end result. And of course, when you approach it that way, you know, you're going to win some races.
I want to talk about you. You won on a John Deere, and it wasn't too long after that you changed to Articat around time for the 1977 race season. And, of course, up here in Thief River Falls, where I'm recording part of the interview right now, is Articat country. I mean, and I couldn't imagine what, you know, I was born a little late to the party with it. But as far as snowmobile culture goes, in the 1970s, up here, you know, in Thief River Falls, and even to certain smaller towns around the area, Articat was a big thing. And what was the reasoning behind the switch from John Deere over to Articat for that 77 race season? And could you tell us a little bit about that race season?
Well, you know, what happened with John Deere is originally in the spring of 76, We were working with engineering, and we were developing a new liquidator. It was going to be called the Liquidator 2, which was going to be a different engine and a much lighter machine. It would have been a lot more competitive sled. And we tested and tested with the thing, and we thought we had a terrific working product. And at the last minute, John Deere decided that they couldn't bring it to market quick enough without more testing. And Hubert and I were convinced at the time that the old liquidator wouldn't be competitive the next year. And we were wrong, because they did make some improvements to it and it was competitive. But, you know, Articat sent a plane down, picked us up, flew us up there, and made us a terrific offer. And we were, you know, at the time, our thought was, you know, how long is John Deere going to stay in this business? And as it turned out, we were correct. They got out of it, you know, in the early 80s. So we knew that at Arctic, you know, racing was heritage. It was in their blood. And as long as Articat was in business, they were going to race snowmobiles. And there was a few other things. Like at Deere, we had to work down at Horicon, Wisconsin, which was a union environment. So, you know, you had to go to work with a tie on and a dress shirt, and you couldn't touch a wrench. And it's not how we like to operate. We wanted to build prototype sleds, improve our race sled, and to do that, you got to be in the shop. You know, you got to be able to build your own sled by hand, but you couldn't do that down in Horicon. So Arctic was just, it fit us better, you might say. And although Deere was a fabulous company, Bob Carlson, who was the senior VP of Deere, he told me once, he said, you have a job for life with this company, wherever you want to go and whatever you want to do. And I've looked back at that at times and figured, God, I could be retired now on a nice pension, you know. But I don't regret going to Arctic, because we had great times there, and we still have a pretty good working relationship with a lot of people at Arctic, and enjoyed our years in Thief River. And in fact, I'm in Thief River quite a bit. You know, we have two events we're putting on up there in the next few weeks, and you know, wherever I go up there, people are more than willing to work with us and help us. And it's just been a terrific relationship with the people up there.
Oh,
but anyway, yeah, we went up there and they made us an offer and we took it. And, there again, took the same approach there as we did at John Deere.
Mm-hmm. And that led you to success and on an El Tigre 6000. The 1978, you weren't too far removed from winning your first I-500, and then you pull it off again. Now, that just solidifies just how good of a team you had and just how good of a race that you were running.
Yeah, we should have won in 77, too. You know, I had a nice lead at the end of the first day. I had a good lead at the end of the second day. And the third day, somehow we got a bunch of water in the gas going from Bemidji to Thief River. I don't know how it got in there. We have some suspicions. But so we were back in about fifth or sixth, I think it was, in Thief River. And then we still had a chance to win the race the last day. We had a perfect sled. Conditions were ideal. And it got windy, and the officials decided to call the race off. And so there we sat in Thief River, and the race was over, and we were, I think, in sixth place. So, you know, we came awful close in 77. Then 78, of course, the race went south, and then that was a sled that Roger Scam at Arctic let Hubert and I design and put together. And so we had our own suspensions and seats and brake systems and everything that we wanted on a sled. And the little El Tigre worked fabulous. You know, I mean, it ran perfect for 600 miles, and we won again.
Now, you talked about getting involved with the development of sleds. The last few years, you got to see a lot of the innovations roll in. And what was that like as far as having an impact on the race itself? I mean, the improvements to some things, things that go a little quicker, things that are a little more sleeker compared to those early days when you were riding the heavier sleds.
Well, you know, to win, of course, you had to be better every year, you know, of course, working with Hubert and engineering at Articat, you know, racing was the forum that developed the consumer sled. And I mean, nobody pushed sleds to the limit harder than people cross country racing. And so what we would develop, of course, followed in a year or two into the consumer division, no different than it does today. And I'm convinced that, you know, the products that we have today all through the last 35, 40 years have been the result of racing. If it wasn't for cross-country racing, we'd probably still be riding around on leaf springs because they were cheap to build. You know, we'd still be building $4,500 sleds and instead of $14,000 sleds. But what we have today, I mean, it's phenomenal. The suspension, the shocks, the handling, the durability, the engines, and the majority of that's come about because of racing. So it was really rewarding to see things that you developed and designed, you know, carrying the sport into the future. And even after we quit racing, you know, we worked with Arctic on development of the ZR and other projects. And like I said, extremely rewarding to see how that blended into the consumer models a few years down the road, and everybody benefited from it.
As far as you, from a racing standpoint, when did you decide that you were going to step away from it and get involved into more of the other, you know, other aspects of the racing industry? What made you decide? When did you decide to do it? And what just made you think that, yeah, I think I'm going to be done with the racing full time. I want to focus on other things.
Well, it really wasn't a choice on our part. You know, we were working at Arctic up until 1980, and, you know, I was 25 years old, the peak of my career, and could have raced for another 10 years and wanted to, but they were locking the doors. And rough times were upon us. You know, I mean, Carter was president, interest was 19%, it didn't snow for 2 years, and, of course, Arctic ended up closing. And so I moved home and bought a marine dealership down here, and that consumed me. You know, I mean, we sold snowmobiles and boats, but we were open 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. Once I had that going, there wasn't really a whole lot of time left for racing. I mean, we did some racing. We ran some teams. We did a lot of development work with Arctic Cat. But as, you know, when Arctic got going again in 84 and 85, by then my business came first. And I wasn't going to lose my business to go racing again. So, you know, we did what we could and stayed involved in a lot of different aspects. We did all the Cats Pride tours for years out west. Like I said, we ran teams, we sponsored racers, we did product development and taught snowmobile training and formed race circuits and on and on and on. You know, we were involved in probably every aspect of the sport, you know, all the way through the 90s.
You know, when you go back to something you mentioned, some of the factors, of course, that brought your career kind of to a pause. One of them was weather, and you know, weather can be so good for the I-500 through the years, but it could also that we've had some really really lighter winters, and that's happened more recently. You know, as we look into the future here, last few years, but just how much of the weather too really could had a factor in on some of those years when you couldn't do the full race.
Yeah, weather, of course, the snowmobile industry lives and dies on weather, you know, and we had a lot more good winters back then than we do now. You know, this global warming thing evidently is real. But, I mean, we had winters back then where we didn't have much snow, too, but it's definitely gotten more prevalent. You know, it's hard to find good winters nowadays.
Let's talk a little bit about what you're up to today, your involvement still in snowmobiling. Let's talk about the USXC, and let's talk about some of these events that are upcoming here in 2019 as far as snowmobile racing.
Yeah, well, that's just, you know, another chapter in our involvement in the snowmobile industry, and it's been fun, and it's been rewarding, and, you know, unfortunately, there was a gentleman by the name of Pat Mock who had USCC. And Pat had started it from scratch and did a great job with it. Him and his parents and his widow ran it, Lisa, and they did a phenomenal job growing it and putting it together. And then, you know, Pat had his tragic accident and passed away. And then the industry kind of came calling. You know, they didn't want the sport to go away. They didn't want the circuit to die. So, you know, I said no for about a year, and then after enough convincing and enough promises from the manufacturers to support, I figured, well, we'll do this for a few years, and then we'll pass it on to somebody. But of course, the passing it on thing is easier said than done, you know. And so we started out in 2013 then, and 2013, and you know, it's been a wild ride. You know, we run 7 to 9 events every winter, and we've got a couple hundred racers that follow the circuit. And it's been extremely rewarding. It, you know, it's challenging at times because of weather. But, you know, it's one of the most rewarding things is all the families that are involved in this sport. And they're getting their kids out away from the computers. They're getting them out doing things together as a family. And I just really like watching that. You know, they're getting these kids out in the woods, out in the ditches, doing something physical, learning to be mechanical, just like we were when we were kids. And they're teaching these kids valuable lessons in life, how to be competitive, how to work with other people, you know, how to succeed, how to be successful, what ingredients does it take? Because the same ingredients that it takes to be successful in a race, you take to a business, your job, anything you do, if you're going to be successful, it's the same ingredients. So it's really, like I said, extremely rewarding to see these families meeting their kids out there and racing.
Well, before we go, I just want to give you the floor one more time. If we haven't mentioned anything that you'd like to talk about here, just I'll have you take the floor here for one more segment. And I do thank you for taking the time.
Well, you're welcome. I appreciate the opportunity, and it's fun to reminisce and go over, you know, how we got from the late 60s up till today. And I just want to say, you know, the snowmobile industry has been really good to me. We've met a lot of people, made a lot of good friends, made friends back in the 60s that are still good friends today because of the sport of snowmobiling. And it's really a close-knit, fun group of people, and that have everybody's back, you might say. And like our Enduro team John Deere members are still tight and close, and you know, you made relationships that you carried with you for your whole life. And I tell our kids now out there racing, you know, keep in mind, you know, to make friends and enjoy this, because it'll go away someday, but the friends that you make and the relationships you establish, you'll carry with you the rest of your life. So it's fun to create an opportunity with USXC for the kids out there to have the same opportunity that we did when we were young.
For Pioneer 90.1, I'm Glenn Brockett. This interview has been brought to you courtesy of the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.